Welcome to the Driven Women Project podcast, where we believe you do not have to act like a man to succeed like one. I'm your host, Erin Smith, and on this episode, we are speaking with Dr. Liz Claiborne. She is an emergency physician and the CEO and co-founder of Nasaclip, which is a medical device for nosebleeds. She's already raised $3.25 million in funding as of December 2023, and she was awarded an NSF SBIR Phase 1 grant for $256,000 to assist with the development of her device. Nasaclip launched as the Band-Aid of nosebleeds in late 2023 on nasaclip.com. And Dr. Liz has been featured on several national interviews on networks like CNN, MSNBC, CBSN, and TEDx, where she talks about COVID-19. She also talks about health equity, ethics and challenges faced by Black female founders. And you can follow her on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at Dr. Eliz PC. That's at Dr. D-R-E-L-I-Z. PC. And in this episode, we talk in depth about finding the courage to be your authentic self. And really, that's about flipping adversity and life's challenges in your favor. Life is full of struggles, right? And it can be especially hard for women and even harder for women of color. And Dr. Liz, I love her because she has mastered the art of believing in herself. Despite the risks that she had to take to raise money and to launch her innovative medical device. And by the way, you and I should all have this medical device as part of our regular first aid kits in our homes and schools. It's amazing. I wish I had had one back in the day. But make sure you listen all the way through this episode, but only if you want to catch Liz's brilliant advice to young women. We have seen so many changes over our lifetimes, and she is realistically optimistic that if women can embrace the challenges that they face and use them to grow, the power that we will feel and the possibilities we'll see are truly endless. So don't forget to visit the show notes after you listen for links to connect directly with her and learn more about Nasaclip. Enjoy the show and stay driven. Dr. Liz, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
My first question, which I ask all of my podcast guests, because it's the Driven Women Project, what does being driven mean to you?
Yeah, you know, I think this is a really kind of interesting question because I'm sure that everyone's answers are so unique, which is why you ask it. And so I had to think about it. And I think that being driven actually means that you have to be in touch with your true authentic self. Mm-hmm. And honest with yourself enough to understand what challenges you, what interests you, and what lights a fire underneath you, and then to have enough courage to pursue that. And I think that that's what being driven means. And for me, I've gone through, I think, a lot of personal struggles, a lot of life experiences that have illuminated, you know, some of my true characteristics that are as close to an authentic self as I can identify at this point in my life. Mm-hmm. And that has really kind of unveiled for me a path that I am excited about pursuing. And it motivates me every day to get up, work hard, and pursue those dreams.
I love that definition. That's really, really empowering, especially the part about courage, because you can, to be driven, you really do have to have that. You've got to have your focus, but then you've got to have that courage to back it up and to go out there and actually, you know, perform the things that are, as you say, part of your core values and core
definitely being. Yeah, I think because a lot of times it's about finding something that might be, you know, going against the grain or not the standard or not traditional. And so you have to be able to be like, okay, am I going to step out of lane here and, you know, venture on my own path? And a lot of that takes courage. And for me in particular, as you'll hear about my career, I left a very traditional, safe, protected path of academic emergency medicine and pursued an entrepreneurial journey. And it definitely took courage for me to like step out there and do that. But I'm so glad that I did. I mean, I think, you know, with no risk, there's no reward. And I think that that definitely pays dividends in the long run, but that first step is the most scary.
Yes. Oh my gosh. There's so much in there. First of all, I talk about cutting away the safety nets in my TED talk, which I can't wait for that to come out for to share that with you. But cutting away the safety nets, like leaving the safety and comfort, like you said, of a steady job, something that you had poured a lot of time and energy into, right? I mean, becoming a physician, especially an emergency one, is no, like, there's no shortcuts to that, right?
Right. A lot of years.
A lot of years. Where did you find the courage to do that? Or how did you, what inspired you to make that leap?
Was, you know, my journey into entrepreneurialism, I think, was almost accidental. Like, I had no intention to, like, go out and do, you know, start a company and be a CEO and founder. I had a problem I experienced as an emergency physician related to nosebleeds and the number of patients I was seeing with nosebleeds in the ER that I thought just really didn't need to be there or didn't have to be there if they had a tool or a device that could treat their nosebleed. And so it started really from curiosity of, like, how can we solve this problem better? And then when I thought I had a solution and I didn't see anywhere else that it existed, I was like, I guess I'm going to be the one that's going to come up with this. And then it started snowballing because it almost started as a, you know, a pet project, something that was on the back burner. And it's very much now, you know, my full-time job, and I'm fully invested in the development of NasoClip and, you know, taking this company to the moon and making it a global brand name for nosebleed rescue. But when I made the transition really of, like, not working full-time as an ER doc and actually working full-time as a CEO was definitely a conscious decision. And it was scary because there's financial consequences, you know, there's kind of almost this, like, what am I doing? Is this a stupid decision? Is it too risky? I have you know, children to think about. And I think for me, I just thought, I won't be able to find out unless I try. And fortunately, as an entrepreneur, because a lot of people do have to truly cut away their safety nets, meaning, like, there is nothing to fall back on, I at least always can fall back on being a physician. So in many ways, I feel like I was a privileged entrepreneur in the sense that I can always go and work as a physician. And I maintain my practice. I still practice about once a week in the ER because I think keeping up my clinical skills and having a good understanding of the hospital space is important, since I'm introducing a medical device that works both for consumers in any environment, but also for medical practitioners and hospitals, urgent cares, ERs, you know, and other medical spaces, that it's good for me to keep up that skill set and be respected as a professional and a physician. But I also recognize that it's allowed me to supplement my income, and it's allowed me to, you know, have a little bit of that safety net. So for me, the step was more about, you know, how are my colleagues going to look at me? Or this is not, you know, what's considered, you know, traditional and maybe even not as, like, prestigious, you could say, to do something like this that's really risky and may not be successful. But I ultimately believed in myself, and I always have. I mean, I believed myself when I wanted to be a physician. And so, of course, I was going to believe in myself when I was venturing into founding a company for a product that I, you know, innovated. And I think that that belief in yourself is what really pushed people forward and allowed me to feel comfortable and have that courage to take that big step.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Belief in yourself. Where do you think you got that from? I mean, talk about growing up. I know a little bit about your background. You told me you played football in high school. So I want to make that known, right? You've been in male dominated spaces your whole life, pretty much. I mean, this podcast is all about being your authentic self and not sacrificing your core values or your innate feminine characteristics, right? And you are very authentic. You're very genuine, and you're a feminine woman, as far as I can see. So,
all of those things, because we're fierce. I love. I actually love being a woman in a male-dominated industry.
Ooh,
I think it's
more.
Such an advantage.
Okay.
Like, I actually sometimes feel sorry for men because I think that they don't have the same lens that we have. They don't process the same way. They don't necessarily always have the same emotional intelligence or empathic intuition that, you know, allows us to make decisions the way we do. But for me, I have been surrounded by women for a long time. I'm the eldest of four girls, so I have three younger sisters. I grew up in Denver, Colorado. As the eldest, obviously, you know, I am a stereotypical firstborn child, really driven overachiever, and always have been. But I think that from a really early age, I was just really tenacious and had no fears of kind of jumping into the unknown. And my parents really also instilled a very early belief that I could do anything. I could accomplish anything, no matter what I looked like or where I was coming from, that I had the capacity to achieve things if I put my mind to it. And so that started early, like, you know, again, so playing football in high school was, again, almost an accident. I was a soccer player and I had a leg, like, I could score from midfield. And so in Colorado, the male soccer season was in the fall at the same time as football, but the female one was in the spring. So I didn't have a primary sport in the fall. And so they approached me about kicking, which I was like, okay, I don't know about this, but I was a place kicker and I was a pretty decent place kicker. I could consistently do field goals in the mid 30s, and was very, very my team was very, very protective of me, but I didn't just kick. Like I did film, skelly, weightlifting, everything with the team. And so I had this very unusual early introduction to this male sport. And you can imagine what high school boys talk about in the locker room. And I
I
heard
yes.
all of that stuff. And I had my own locker. People ask about this all the time. I had my own like bathroom outside the male locker room, but I did have to go in the kind of common area sometimes to get taped. So in general, just the social environment, they kind of shared everything and I got the male insight. But I think that that was really formative for me moving forward with always feeling like I could feel comfortable and at ease and make others feel at ease around me, even if I was like the minority in the sense of being the only woman or the minority in the sense of being maybe the only Black person. And so I felt always felt really comfortable in those situations, primarily because I had early experiences like playing football. But then it also built my confidence because I was good at something that, typically you wouldn't think a girl was good at. And I was strong and I could lift weights. And, they loved that I was also smart and I could, give them girl advice on all the things that they were curious about. And so I think from an early age, I was always willing to take risks and kind of look for opportunities that were unusual. And that continues to afford me, I think, success in the future because I'm never afraid of trying something that's a little different or off the beaten path.
Yes, trying something new and something different, because that's what we're talking about here, right? Like not trying to fit in, not sacrificing who you are in order to just blend, but to take a risk and say, like, I'm going to try something that's different. I've never done it before. I don't know how it's going to be received, but here goes. I love how you said in the beginning, you'll never know unless you try. Right? So you also talk about how women of color are primed to be our best leaders. Can you tell us a little bit more, share some of your insights on that? Because I wonder, you talk about how you grew up and how that experience pushed you into this arena where you're comfortable taking risks and being courageous. But I'm sure you've experienced pushback. I'm sure you've experienced, the difficulties that come from being a woman of color, a woman, number one, a woman of color. So talk to me about how you think about that and being primed to be the
Yeah,
best
and
leader.
thank you for asking, Erin. As obviously, our connection is that we both met at a program that was training us to be, powerful public speakers. And the big idea that I have for my keynote is that I believe that women, and especially women of color, are primed to be our best leaders. And the reason I believe that is if you look at any historic leader, they have some combined traits that you will always see, and it usually relates to their resilience, their innovation, their courage, some of the things that we talked about. And if you look at what women are required to go through, we just by the very nature of surviving, our usual circumstance, in my opinion, are better prepared to deal with uncertainties, unknowns, having to communicate. It's almost like being a woman, and particularly a woman of color that might be pushed through difficult circumstance just because of, maybe you had to work a little harder, or you were born with not as many economic assets as others, or you had a lot of prejudice that you were dealing with. All those things are training materials that actually prepare you to be more resilient and to look for, unique and innovative ways to solve problems and to have courage and pride that can take you through difficult times. And those are the characteristics of strong leaders. Even if you look at our typical, maybe white male strong leader, they in their past are going to have some kind of turmoil, some kind of strife, some kind of challenge that made them a brilliant leader. And what my speech points out is that there are probably diamonds in the rough all around us of women that protect that actually possess those exact characteristics, but we tend to overlook them because we have a lot of unconscious bias that, that they can't have those same characteristics at that same level. And my argument is like we have it in spades because we've been playing this game since birth. You know what I mean? Like I played football in high school and then I went to Duke University, which is a predominantly white institution, and had to kind of deal with that there. And then, even being in a STEM, type career is a challenge as a woman, and especially a woman of color. And being a physician continues to be a challenge, especially as a woman and a woman of color. I share a story in my keynote about how I go into, and this is not an uncommon story, but one example is I've walked into a patient room. This lady was probably in her like 50s, I want to say. And she was like breathing really fast and uncomfortable and had been vomiting and was really anxious and worried. And when I walked in, I came in with this really tall white male medical student, and he had his short white coat on and his badge that said medical student. And of course, I have my long coat on and my badge that says doctor on it. And I introduce myself as Dr. Claiborne, and I start talking to her, and she's there with her husband and her son, and they're all like turned towards my medical student. And I realize they're not even talking to me. They like are assuming he is the authority in the room. Because he's tall and he's male and he's white. So, of course, he has to be in charge. And so I just was like, okay, let's play into this. So I turned to the student. I'm like, so what is going on? Like, what are we going to do here? And of course, the medical student's like squirming in their pants. Like, I don't know. I'm just a medical student here. And I'm like, I was like, so, I let him propose a plan. And then it became clear that they were like, maybe he doesn't know what he's talking about quite yet. So I explained, like, I think you're probably in DKA and you probably have diabetes, and we're going to give you some fluids and insulin, and made them feel at rest. But that is not an uncommon experience. If you talk to a lot of minority physicians, like, they're going to have an experience similar to that. And we kind of laugh it off, but in some ways, like, it's not that funny, right? Like, I very clearly was an authority in that room, and even though I had all the visual things in front of me, it was just still very hard for them to connect that I was the doctor and that I was the attending physician.
Which I'm sure becomes a hurdle, even after they realize, oh, whoops, we had the wrong person. You're probably they probably still have those biases
Oh
inside
yeah,
their
I mean, they'll
minds.
still say nurse. They'll still say, "Oh, the nurse said this," and I'll have to be like, "The doctor said this." So, I think you have to be gracious with it, because I've learned that people are going to be more responsive to you if you are confident and strong, and that you back up and definitely take pride in your position and don't cower when people make mistakes like that. You should correct them, but you still need to like gently correct them and make them willing and able to understand that they probably should be more careful when they're making assumptions about who you are and what your role is, just based on how you look.
Especially if their medical care depends on it. You would think they would be even more like, wait, let's get this right. I love that. I love that concept of using adversity of any kind, or even an annoying thing, or something that someone's saying to you that's just like, why is that person saying that to me? Using it in your favor, to your advantage for a second there, right? You're like, okay, well, let's see where this goes. If they think he's the authority here, let's watch them undo their own bias. Like, I was wrong to think that that was the person who was going to tell me what was going on. Imagine if they had leaned on that person, right? And gotten the wrong information, and here you are, like the
And
expert
in
in.
many ways, maybe they'll never forget it again, right? Which is why I say I actually love being, a woman in a male-dominated industry, because I think I'm chronically underestimated, and I love being underestimated. It just allows me to show up even brighter and even bigger, because it comes from this place of surprise and like, oh, I can't believe that she actually can do this, even though I know I can do it. And I think that, again, you always have to thread a needle as a woman, though, that I think is challenging, because I don't ever want to dim my light, but I don't also want to be perceived as being overly confident or cocky. And unfortunately, there's a lot of pressures on women to not be too strong or too loud or too aggressive, right? Which are some adjectives that unfortunately get adhered to people from my particular background that can be really negative. And so what I tell a lot of women is that I think that there's a way to be strong and to be powerful and to have presence that is still elegant, that is still feminine, that is still soft in the way that they want to see you as a woman. And I think that for some reason, it's hard for me to articulate exactly how you do that. For me, it's just like being confident in who I am, but not also afraid to show, what they would consider a softer or weaker side. Like, when something upsets me, You know, I have cried in public before. If something shocks me, I can be honest about that. I don't think that you always need to shield all of your emotions all of the time. I think there is a time and place for you to always show your human side. And especially in medicine, we're always expected to be really professional. And some of the things I do that might be a little atypical as emergency physician is I often will talk to patients about what I personally think. Like if this was my family member, you know, this is what I would do. If this was happening to me, this is what I would do. If I have a patient that is going through a miscarriage, I will share. I've had two miscarriages. Okay. I miscarried twins and then went on to have a healthy baby girl. I share those stories because that human connection is so important in helping people to understand both that you know what you're talking about, but also that you don't just like informationally, right, or logically understand the problem, but that you emotionally understand the problem. And that builds trust. And I think that gets you a lot further in business, in medicine, and wherever you are in life.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah, connect that connection. And that connection can be thwarted if you were to just be, you know what, I'm not talking to this person now because they got it wrong. Screw
Right.
them or whatever, right? Like, or if you put up that wall,
Yep.
that's usually anger, right? Like if you're angry about something, you can be, sure. Like there's nothing wrong with that. But if that's all you project, then it's gonna make it harder for you to connect with
Right. And
people
people
and really.
underestimate the ability for others to feel your emotions. Like even if you think you're saying and doing everything correctly, if your attitude is stank, they will pick up on that. Seriously. It's actually kind of, it's harder than you might think. Like I think most people don't understand that like there's a lot that's communicated non-verbally. And so even if you are smiling and you know saying all the right things, or even if you're being you know really professional, if there's something on going on under the surface, like a lot of people are still going to be able to pick up on that. And I think it's important to acknowledge that and use it to your advantage when you can.
I completely agree with that. And it is an art form. It is really challenging to kind of pinpoint like exactly how do you do that? But I think being aware of that and knowing your options and the rewards that you will reap
Right.
when you refine your approach and say like, all right, I'm going to use this
Yes.
to my advantage right now. And maybe this is a teaching moment. I can help this person, figure out
Right.
how to act in the future.
Right.
Amazing. So I actually saw a stat. I want to talk to you about your role as CEO and starting this company and getting funding. I saw a stat that you had posted about that I found really shocking, and I know to be true. It said that white men only have to go through seven people to get a yes, and a black women have to go through 70. So I'm wondering what was your experience like? Because I've worked a lot in the investment space and venture capital, and I know how white male dominated it is, and how the tendency is to give money to people who look like you or who you can relate to or that you can understand better. So yeah, what was your experience like? And because you've been successful in raising, how much money have you raised so far? Are you allowed to
To
share that?
date, we've raised 3.25 million.
Yay, that's
So
amazing.
you know, so I'll back up. So I think that first, my success with fundraising has come, I think, primarily because I've become really adept at being an excellent pitcher. And that became that was also a skill that I picked up because I did so much public speaking before I became a founder and was on live television a lot. I was pregnant during the pandemic and ended up doing quite a bit of national television, which I thought was important at the time because I didn't see that many Black female physicians on TV that were articulate and well educated and, you know, speaking to maybe a patient population that might have been a little untrusting of the healthcare system. And I thought that it was important to serve that role at that time. But what I didn't know is that that was really training me to be an excellent speaker and clear and concise and confident in the way that I deliver my messages. And that has translated very well to me being great at pitching. And so that was one of the skill sets. But I think the other is that you just have to be you cannot give up. Like you do have to go through a lot of numbers and you can't have like too soft of skin. Like you have to be able to roll off the nose and like keep
Yeah.
looking for the yes, because statistically, yes. I mean, you're going through 10 times the number of contacts to get that one yes or a return on an investment. And so you need to have some tough skin to get through the nose and understand that it's not always a reflection of you or your company. It
Yeah.
might be a reflection of you not being a good fit, but it also is largely a reflection of just unconscious bias. And what I talk a lot about in my speech and when I talk on this particular topic of venture capital, because we still only have about 2% of venture capital going to women, is that really the only thing that can account for such a discrepancy of like billions and billions of dollars and only 2% of it going to female founders
Yeah.
is that there is an unconscious bias that investing in women or people of color, because those statistics are also terrible, is more risky. And
Yeah.
that they are used to seeing success come out of maybe a background that looks more similar to them. And because this kind of investment is high risk, and people are very risk adverse, they're going to invest in something that they think is safe, and they perceive something that they know as safe. And so what I try to do is tear down those perceptions and say, actually, women represent 2% of venture capital funding, but 17% of unicorn exits. We tend to be faster to actually producing revenue, faster to profitability. Like statistically, we actually outperform all male or all white teams.
Yeah.
And so if you don't want to talk about what's going to be a safe investment, maybe you should look at, investing in someone like me. But even with those statistics, it's still hard because they have to overcome the inertia of just doing what they've always done.
Right.
So I try to always
Yes.
make sure I'm representing the best and brightest of my demographic, that I'm really clear about talking about, my device and why I think that it's going to be a game changer and is going to be a global brand name that everyone will recognize in the future. And I think ultimately, early on in fundraising, a lot of investors are investing in the jockey, right? They're investing in me. Yes, they'll probably look at my market. Yes, they'll make sure that, my technology is tight and that it looks like something sound that solves a real problem. But a lot of times it's like a gestalt or a feeling that they have about the CEO and founder. And I think that I've been more successful than a lot of other people because I can communicate and connect with them and make them trust me and trust me with their money, with their investment to,
Yes.
ensure that they're going to get a return. Because I often bring up that, I'm not asking for charity. This is not just a social impact, investment. You're
Right.
not throwing your money away. I will make a turn on your money.
Yeah.
And that is what I like to, make sure that I'm articulating, that it's not just because it's the right moral thing to do. And it is, believe me, given the statistics, it is actually what we should be doing, is paying more attention to supporting early stage startups that have female and Black founders. But in addition to that, it's also probably statistically a safer way for you to make sure you get a good return on your investment.
I love it. You're mixing it all up. You're mixing in you, what you bring to the table, and what you know will happen as a result
Yes.
of investing in you. I love that. So you mentioned you have two daughters, right? What, how do you, how are you bringing them up? Like, what are, because I imagine having you as a mom, like, because you got, you said you mentioned you had supportive parents or parents who encouraged you to put yourself out there. What are you, what's the thing that you want to impart on your girls in this day and age? And what do you want them to take away as they grow up and go out into the world?
Yeah, that's a great question as well. And I mean, I think it actually relates to the first question you asked me. Like, I just want my girls to believe that they can have it all, that they can do anything, be anything, have anything. And so if they grow up and they want to be in the arts, or they want to pursue a career, or they want to make sure they have a family, or they want to make sure that this, earth is left a better, way than in which it was, they entered it, they can do that. And I think that I also want to make sure I emphasize to them that part of their job is to be happy. Because I think that that part is lost a little bit in the hustle and bustle and all the drive right towards achieving things, that, it is actually an accomplishment to live a happy and fulfilling life. And I think sometimes I worry, because I am an overachiever and I am doing all these things and I'm very public facing, that it's going to put a lot of pressure on them to also be high performers. So it's going to be important for me to emphasize that at the end of the day, I just want you to live a happy and fulfilling life, and that you find something that you're passionate about, and that you can grow up and do something that makes you feel good about yourself, and hopefully, also contributes to others.
Yes, that's so amazing. And that does tie back to the first question. Like, what does being driven mean to you? What does a fulfilling life mean to you? And then giving that to your daughters as an opportunity for them to make their own definition. Like, this is what it is for you, Dr. Liz. What is it for society? Like, society is constantly telling us like what success is, right? It's material things, or it's the big house, it's the fancy car, or whatever, like being married with however many kids. Those definitions do not have to be yours. They don't have to be your daughter's. They can make up their own. I think that's one of the most empowering things that, had I known that when I was younger, would have changed my perspective, right? I eventually learned it, and I'm glad for that. But yeah, I love that that you're telling
And
them like
it's an
whatever's.
amazing time to be a woman. Like, I'm really excited for my daughters because for my generation, so many things have been different, and there's so many more opportunities for me as a woman. And for theirs, like, it continues to open up. Like, I think we're entering an era where we're going to see the highest number of women in positions of power that we've ever seen. And in my opinion, you're going to see the fruits of those labors done, and that that the world is going to change as we get more women in these positions of power and positions of leadership. But I am excited that, like, the world's going to be their oyster. Like, they're going to be able to shape and live however they want, and there's not going to be as many prescriptions and, ideas about what is appropriate for them or not appropriate for them. And the younger generation seems so much more open to everything, like the way that families are structured, the way that, we're approaching education, the way you approach your career, and even like the way you approach your happiness. So it should be an interesting ride. So I am excited to see, what they'll be able to do, because I think about often, like, how significant of a different life I live compared to my mother, my grandmother, my great grandmother, right? I talk in my speech again about how, in many ways, I'm my ancestors' wildest dreams, right? My dad's family were emancipated as slaves from a plantation in North Carolina, went to Indiana, basically sharecropped and got land in that area, built it up, but had a generation, one generation out of slavery, that all went to high school, and all the men actually went to college, which is just for the 1930s is unheard of. And so to go from a generation that was enslaved to two generations later having, people who are graduating from Ivy League colleges is amazing. And so, but even at that time, they still probably could never imagine, like, oh, their great, great, great granddaughter is going to be a physician and a CEO and being raised and is going to raise millions of dollars for her company and speak on national television and, or be able to do any of the things that I'm doing right now. Or even the, fact that I had to go through a divorce while I was building my company and, like, made a decision to, like, leave my marriage. That would have been a challenge one to two generations ago. And so it's exciting for me to see, like, how we will continue to evolve. And in many ways, I see opportunities continuing to open up more and more, especially for women, as we move forward.
Yeah, that's amazing. Wow. And thank you for sharing that history with us, because yeah, it's incredible to think back. It doesn't seem like that long ago in the blip of, humanity, but I mean, for that much change to happen in that period of time, super excited to see what happens next and how we carry the messages that we're learning now forward into the future generations. So I am so glad that I got to talk to you today, and I can't wait to share this episode. Is there anything else that you would want to share, or any like thoughts or
Oh yeah, I
ideas,
mean, I'm a
or
true entrepreneur, so I have to show
do
you my
it. Let's
and give
hear
you
it.
my pitch.
Yes, let's hear it.
So, I came up with the idea of NasoClip because we see 500,000 ER visits a year for nosebleeds. And I just couldn't believe that people would come to the ER for such a simple problem. And I learned that people tend to mismanage their nosebleeds. Like, they pitch the wrong part of their nose, they put their head back instead of forward, they don't hold constant pressure. And because nosebleeds are most common in kids 2 to 10, and then older adults 55 to 80, I think they panic. And so they'll end up in the ER. And I used to, as a resident, tape together tongue depressors or, like, make a clip. And so I just realized there just needs to be a better way to treat nosebleeds. So this is NasoClip.
So cool.
You can check us out on nasoclip.com, NASACLIP. It has sponges that can be medicated. So if you're having a nosebleed, you simply clear your nose of clot, insert the nasal sponges, or rotate it into place, and pinch shut.
Oh my
So it
gosh.
just holds firm, constant, uninterrupted pressure to the
Yeah.
right location of your nose.
Yeah.
You would leave this in place for about 10 to 20 minutes and then release the clip and check for bleeding. And
Wow.
you actually can rinse it off and reinsert. So if you're still oozing, and it comes in adult and pediatric sizes. So this is for ages 2 to 13. So we
Wow.
consider ourselves to be the Band-Aid of nosebleeds. So that's my global brand name I keep talking about that everyone's going to have in their medicine cabinet sometime in the future.
Absolutely.
And outside of that, I just want to share that, it's really hard sometimes to be a woman, but it's the hardness that makes you brilliant. It's the difficulty that actually creates your divine inspiration. So even though it can be really painful, and a lot of us live through painful experiences and challenges that I think are unique to being a woman in a professional world. In some ways, I'm learning more and more to be grateful for those experiences because they have sharpened my edge in a way that I can carve the life that I want and make it so amazing and actually like so much more brilliant than I ever imagined. So now when I encounter things that I'm like not as excited about and that are difficult, I always try to pause and look for where is this lesson? What is this experience teaching me that's going to make me stronger and more fierce for the future?
Oh my God, I have full body chills. That is so amazing. Yes. And you have a TED Talk too, and you're constantly speaking. I mean, you're an amazing speaker. You're very,
Thank
you evoke
you.
so
I
much
appreciate
emotion.
that.
And your message is so important. So I'm so glad that you took the time to share it with me and my audience. And yeah, I'm so excited. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Erin. This work is so important. And so I hope you continue to do it. And I hope you continue to shine light on us.
Absolutely. You as well. Thanks, Dr. Liz.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Thank you for listening. As always, take the messages you've heard here and try them on like an outfit. If it doesn't fit, don't try to force it. If it does fit, great. Consider sharing the episode, or even better, leave us a review. And if you or another driven woman you know would be willing to share her proverbial closet of advice about working in a male-dominated field, see the notes below for a link to nominate her to be on the show. Until next time, stay driven.